in a wholly unpredictable, even devastating way.
Malcolm sat back in his seat, looking toward the other land cruiser a few yards ahead.
That's a deep truth about the structure of our universe, but for some reason we insist on behaving as if it were not true.
At that moment, the cars jolted to a stop.
What's happened? Grant said.
Up ahead, they saw the kids in the car pointing toward the ocean. Offshore, beneath lowering clouds, Grant saw the dark outline of the supply boat making its way back toward Punta Arenas.
Why have we stopped? Malcolm said.
Grant turned on the radio and heard the girl saying excitedly,
Look there, Timmy! You see it? It's there!
Malcolm squinted at the boat.
They talking about the boat?
Apparently. Ed Regis climbed out of the front car and came running back to their window.
I'm sorry, he said, but the kids are all worked up. Do you have binoculars here?
For what?
The little girl says she sees something on the boat, some kind of animal, Regis said.
Grant grabbed the binoculars and rested his elbows on the window ledge of the land cruiser. He scanned the long shape of the supply ship. It was so dark it was almost a silhouette. As he watched, the ship's running lights came on, brilliant in the dark purple twilight.
Do you see anything? Regis said.
No, Grant said.
They're low down, Lex said over the radio. Look low down!
Grant tilted the binoculars down, scanning the hull just above the waterline. The supply ship was broad-beamed with a splash flange that ran the length of the ship, but it was quite dark now, and he could hardly make out details.
No, nothing. I can see them, Lex said impatiently. Near the back! Look near the back!
How can she see anything in this light? Malcolm said.
Kids can see, Grant said. They've got visual acuity we forgot we ever had.
He swung the binoculars toward the stern, moving them slowly, and suddenly he saw the animals. They were playing, darting among the silhouetted stern structures. He could see them only briefly, but even in the fading light he could tell that they were upright animals, about 2 feet tall, standing with stiff, balancing tails.
You see them now?
Lex said.
I see them, he said.
What are they?
They're raptors, Grant said. At least 2, maybe more, juveniles.
Jesus, Ed Regis said. That boat's going to the mainland.
Malcolm shrugged. Don't get excited, just call the control room and tell them to recall the boat. Ed Regis reached in and grabbed the radio from the dashboard. They heard hissing static and clicks as he rapidly changed channels.
There's something wrong with this one, he said. It's not working.
He ran off to the first land cruiser. They saw him duck into it. Then he looked back at them.
There's something wrong with both the radios, he said. I can't raise the control room.
Then let's get going, Grant said. In the control room, Muldoon stood before the big windows that overlooked the park. At 7 o'clock, the quartz floodlights came on all over the island, turning the landscape into a glowing jewel stretching away to the south. This was his favorite moment of the day. He heard the crackle of static from the radios.
The land cruisers have started again, Arnold said. They're on their way home.
But why did they stop? Hammond said. And why can't we talk to them?
I don't know, Arnold said. Maybe they turned off the radios in the cars.
Probably the storm, Muldoon said. Interference from the storm. They'll be here in 20 minutes, Hammond said. You better call down and make sure the dining room is ready for them. Those kids are going to be hungry.
Arnold picked up the phone and heard a steady, monotonous hiss.
What's this? What's going on?
Jesus, hang that up, Nedry said. You'll screw up the data stream.
You've taken all the phone lines, even the internal ones?
I've taken all the lines that communicate outside, Nedry said, but your internal line should still work.
Arnold punched console buttons one after another. He heard nothing but hissing on all the lines.
Looks like you've got them all.
Sorry about that, Nedry said. I'll clear a couple for you at the end of the next transmission, in about 15 minutes.
He yawned. Looks like a long weekend for me. I guess I'll go get that Coke now.
He picked up his shoulder bag and headed for the door.
Don't touch my console, okay?
The door closed.
What a slob, Hammond said. Yeah, Arnold said, but I guess he knows what he's doing.
Along the side of the road, clouds of volcanic steam misted rainbows in the bright quartz lights. Grant said into the radio. How long does it take the ship to reach the mainland?
18 hours, Ed Regis said, more or less. It's pretty reliable.
He glanced at his watch. It should arrive around 11 tomorrow morning. Grant frowned. You still can't talk to the control room?
Not so far.
How about Harding? Can you reach him?
No, I've tried. He may have his radio turned off.
Malcolm was shaking his head. So we're the only ones who know about the animals on the ship.
I'm trying to raise somebody, Ed Regis said. I mean, Christ, we don't want those animals on the mainland.
How long until we get back to the base?
From here, another 16-17 minutes, Ed Regis said.
At night, the whole road was illuminated by big floodlights. It felt to Grant as if they were driving through a bright green tunnel of leaves. Large raindrops spattered the windshield. Grant felt the land cruiser slow, then stop.
Now what?
Lex said,
I don't want to stop. Why do we stop?
And then suddenly, all the floodlights went out. The road was plunged into darkness. Lex said,
Hey!
Probably just a power outage or something, Ed Regis said. I'm sure the lights will be on in a minute.
What the hell?
Arnold said, staring at his monitors. What happened? Muldoon said. You lose power?
Yeah, but only power on the perimeter. Everything in this building's working fine.
But outside in the park, the power's gone. Lights, TV cameras, everything. His remote video monitors had gone black.
Now what about the two land cruisers?
Stopped somewhere around the Tyrannosaur paddock.
Well, Muldoon said, call maintenance and let's get the power back on.
Arnold picked up one of his phones and heard hissing, Nedry's computers talking to each other.
No phones, that damn Nedry.
Nedry? Where the hell is he? Dennis Nedry pushed open the door marked fertilization. With the perimeter power out, all the security card locks were disarmed. Every door in the building opened with a touch. The problems with the security system were high on Jurassic Park's bug list. Nedry wondered if anybody ever imagined that it wasn't a bug, that Nedry had programmed it that way. He had built in a classic trap door. Few programmers of large computer systems could resist the temptation to leave themselves a secret entrance. Partly it was common sense. If inept users locked up the system and then called you for help, you always had a way to get in and repair the mess. And partly it was a kind of signature. Kilroy was here. And partly it was insurance for the future. Nedry was annoyed with the Jurassic Park project. Late in the schedule, InGen had demanded extensive modifications to the system, but hadn't been willing to pay for them, arguing they should be included under the original contract. Lawsuits were threatened, letters were written to Nedry's other clients implying that Nedry was unreliable. It was blackmail, and in the end, Nedry had been forced to eat his overages on Jurassic Park and to make the changes that Hammond wanted. But later, when he was approached by Lewis Dodgson at Biosyn, Nedry was ready to listen, and able to say that he could indeed get past Jurassic Park security. He could get into any room, any system, anywhere in the park, because he had programmed it that way, just in case. He entered the fertilization room. The lab was deserted. As he had anticipated, all the staff was at dinner. Nedry unzipped his shoulder bag and removed the can of Gillette shaving cream. He unscrewed the base and saw the interior was divided into a series of cylindrical slots. He pulled on a pair of heavy insulated gloves and opened the walk-in freezer marked Contents Viable, Biological, Maintain Minus 10 Degrees Centigrade Minimum. The freezer was the size of a small closet, with shelves from floor to ceiling. Most of the shelves contained reagents and liquids in plastic sacks. To one side he saw a smaller nitrogen cold box with a heavy ceramic door. He opened it, and a rack of small tubes slid out in a cloud of white liquid nitrogen smoke. The embryos were arranged by species, Stegosaurus, Apatosaurus, Hadrosaurus, Tyrannosaurus, each embryo in a thin glass container wrapped in silver foil, stoppered with polylene. Nedry quickly took two of each, slipping them into the shaving cream can. Then he screwed the base of the can shut and twisted the top. There was a hiss of releasing gas inside, and the can frosted in his hands. Dodgson had said there was enough coolant to last 36 hours. more than enough time to get back to San Jose. Nedry left the freezer, returned to the main lab. He dropped the can back in his bag, zipped it shut. He went back into the hallway. The theft had taken less than 2 minutes. He could imagine the consternation upstairs in the control room as they began to realize what had happened. All their security codes were scrambled and all their phone lines were jammed. Without his help, it would take hours to untangle the mess. But in just a few minutes, Nedry would be back in the control room setting things right, and no one would ever suspect what he had done. Grinning, Dennis Nedry walked down to the ground floor, nodded to the guard, and continued downstairs to the basement. Passing the neat lines of electric Land Cruisers, he went to the gasoline-powered Jeep parked against the wall. He climbed into it, noticing some odd gray tubing on the passenger seat. It looked almost like a rocket launcher, he thought, as he turned the ignition key and started the Jeep. Nedry glanced at his watch. From here into the park, and 3 minutes straight to the East Dock. 3 minutes from there, back to the control room. Piece of cake. Damn it, Arnold said, punching buttons on the console. It's all screwed up. Muldoon was standing at the windows looking out at the park. The lights had gone out all over the island, except in the immediate area around the main buildings. He saw a few staff personnel hurrying to get out of the rain, but no one seemed to realize anything was wrong. Muldoon looked over at the visitor lodge, where the lights burned brightly. "Uh-oh," Arnold said. "We have real trouble." "What's that?" Muldoon said. He turned away from the window, and so he didn't see the Jeep drive out of the underground garage and head east along the maintenance road into the park. "That idiot Nedry turned off the security systems," Arnold said. "The whole building's opened up. None of the doors are locked anymore." "I'll notify the guards," Muldoon said. "That's the least of it," Arnold said. "When you turn off the security, you turn off all the peripheral fences as well." "The fences?" Muldoon said. "The electrical fences," Arnold said. "They're off, all over the island." "You mean..." "That's right," Arnold said. "The animals can get out now." Arnold lit a cigarette. "Probably nothing will happen, but you never know." Muldoon started toward the door. "I better drive out and bring in the people and those two Land Cruisers," he said, "just in case." Muldoon quickly went downstairs to the garage. He wasn't really worried about the fences going down. Most of the dinosaurs had been in their paddocks for 9 months or more, and they had brushed up against the fences more than once, with notable results. Muldoon knew how quickly animals learn to avoid shock stimuli. You could train a laboratory pigeon with just 2 or 3 stimulation events. So it was unlikely the dinosaurs would now approach the fences. Muldoon was more concerned about what the people in the cars would do. He didn't want them getting out of the Land Cruisers, because once the power came back on, the cars would start moving again whether the people were inside them or not. They might be left behind. Of course, in the rain, it was unlikely they would leave the cars, but still, you never knew. He reached the garage and hurried toward the Jeep. It was lucky, he thought, that he had had the foresight to put the launcher in it. He could start right out and be out there and... It was gone. "What the hell?" Muldoon stared at the empty parking space, astonished. The Jeep was gone. What the hell was happening? Fourth iteration. Inevitably, underlying instabilities begin to appear. Ian Malcolm. The Main Road. Rain drummed loudly on the roof of the Land Cruiser. Tim felt the night vision goggles pressing heavily on his forehead. He reached for the knob near his ear and adjusted the intensity. There was a brief phosphorescent flare, and then, in shades of electronic green and black, he could see the Land Cruiser behind, with Dr. Grant and Dr. Malcolm inside. Neat. Dr. Grant was staring out the front windshield toward him. Tim saw him pick up the radio from the dash. There was a burst of static, and then he heard Dr. Grant's voice. "Can you see us back here?" Tim picked up the radio from Ed Regis.
"I see you."
"Everything all right?"
"We're fine, Dr. Grant."
"Stay in the car."
"We will, don't worry."
He clicked the radio off. Ed Regis snorted. "It's pouring down rain. Of course we'll stay in the car," he muttered. Tim turned to look at the foliage at the side of the road. Through the goggles, the foliage was a bright electronic green, and beyond he could see sections of the green grid pattern of the fence. The land cruisers were stopped on the downslope of a hill, which must mean they were someplace near the Tyrannosaur area. It would be amazing to see a Tyrannosaur with these night vision goggles, a real thrill. Maybe the Tyrannosaur would come to the fence and look over at them. Pym wondered if its eyes would glow in the dark when he saw them. That would be neat. But he didn't see anything, and eventually he stopped looking. Everyone in the cars fell silent. The rain thrummed on the roof of the car, sheets of water streamed down over the sides of the windows. It was hard for Tim to see out, even with the goggles. "How long have we been sitting here?" Malcolm asked. "I don't know, 4 or 5 minutes. I wonder what the problem is. Maybe a short circuit from the rain. But it happened before the rain really started." There was another silence. In a tense voice, Lex said,
"But there's no lightning, right?"
She'd always been afraid of lightning, and she now sat nervously squeezing her leather mitt in her hands. Dr. Grant said, "What was that? We didn't quite read that."
"Just my sister talking."
"Oh." Tim again scanned the foliage, but saw nothing. Certainly nothing as big as a tyrannosaur. He began to wonder if the tyrannosaurs came out at night. Were they nocturnal animals? Tim wasn't sure if he had ever read that. He had the feeling the tyrannosaurs were all-weather, day or night animals. The time of day didn't matter to a tyrannosaur. The rain continued to pour. "Hell of a rain," Ed Regis said. "It's really coming down." Lex said,
"I'm hungry."
"I know that, Lex," Regis said, "but we're stuck here, sweetie. The cars run on electricity and buried cables in the road."
"Stuck for how long?"
"Until they fix the electricity." Listening to the sound of the rain, Tim felt himself growing sleepy. He yawned and turned to look at the palm trees on the left side of the road and was startled by a sudden thump as the ground shook. He swung back just in time to catch a glimpse of a dark shape as it swiftly crossed the road between the two cars.
"Jesus!"
"What was it?"
"It was huge. It was as big as the car."
"Tim, are you there?" He picked up the radio.
"Yes, I'm here."
"Did you see it, Tim?"
"No," Tim said. "I missed it."
"What the hell was it?" Malcolm said. "Are you wearing the night vision goggles, Tim?"
"Yes, I'll watch," Tim said.
"Was it the Tyrannosaur?" Ed Regis asked.
"I don't think so. It was in the road."
"But you didn't see it," Ed Regis said.
"No."
Tim felt bad that he had missed seeing the animal, whatever it was. There was a sudden white crack of lightning, and his night goggles flared bright green. He blinked his eyes and started counting. 1 1,000, 2 1,000. The thunder crashed, deafeningly loud and very close. Lex began to cry.
"Oh, no!"
"Take it easy, honey," Ed Regis said. "It's just lightning." Tim scanned the side of the road. The rain was coming down hard now, shaking the leaves with hammering drops. It made everything move. Everything seemed alive. He scanned the leaves. He stopped. There was something beyond the leaves. Tim looked up higher. Behind the foliage, beyond the fence, he saw a thick body with a pebbled, grainy surface like the bark of a tree. But it wasn't a tree. He continued to look higher, sweeping the goggles upward. He saw the huge head of the Tyrannosaurus just standing there, looking over the fence at the two land cruisers. The lightning flashed again, and the big animal rolled its head and bellowed in the glaring light. Then darkness and silence again, and the pounding rain. "Tim?"
"Yes, Dr. Grant?"
"You see what it is?"
"Yes, Dr. Grant."
Tim had the sense that Dr. Grant was trying to talk in a way that wouldn't upset his sister. "What's going on right now?"
"Nothing,"
Tim said, watching the Tyrannosaur through his night goggles.
"Just standing on the other side of the fence."
"I can't see much from here, Tim."
"I can see fine, Dr. Grant. It's just standing there."
"Okay." Lex continued to cry, snuffling. There was another pause. Tim watched the Tyrannosaur. The head was huge. The animal looked from one vehicle to another, then back again. It seemed to stare right at Tim. In the goggles, the eyes glowed bright green. Tim felt a chill, but then as he looked down the animal's body, moving down from the massive head and jaws,
he saw the smaller, muscular forelimb. It waved in the air, and then it gripped the fence.
Jesus Christ, Ed Regis said, staring out the window.
The greatest predator the world has ever known, the most fearsome attack in human history. Somewhere in the back of his publicist's brain, Ed Regis was still writing copy, but he could feel his knees begin to shake uncontrollably, his trousers flapping like flags.
Jesus, he was frightened. He didn't want to be here.
Alone among all the people in the two cars, Ed Regis knew what a dinosaur attack was like. He knew what happened to people. He had seen the mangled bodies that resulted from a raptor attack. He could picture it in his mind, and this was a Rex, much, much bigger. The greatest meat-eater that ever walked the earth.
Jesus!
When the Tyrannosaur roared, it was terrifying, a scream from some other world. Ed Regis felt the spreading warmth in his trousers. He'd peed in his pants. He was simultaneously embarrassed and terrified. But he knew he had to do something. He couldn't just stay here. He had to do something. Something! His hands were shaking, trembling against the dash.
Jesus Christ! He said again.
Bad language, Lex said, wagging her finger at him.
Tim heard the sound of a door opening, and he swung his head away from the Tyrannosaur. The night vision goggles streaked laterally, in time to see Ed Regis stepping out through the open door, ducking his head in the rain.
Hey, Lex said, where are you going?
Ed Regis just turned and ran in the opposite direction from the Tyrannosaur, disappearing into the woods. The door to the Land Cruiser hung open. The paneling was getting wet.
He left, Lex said. Where did he go? He left us alone.
Shut the door, Tim said.
But she had started to scream.
He left us! He left us!
Tim, what's going on? It was Dr. Grant on the radio. Tim! Tim leaned forward and tried to shut the door. From the back seat, he couldn't reach the handle. He looked back at the Tyrannosaur as lightning flashed again, momentarily silhouetting the huge black shape against the white flaring sky. Tim, what's happening?
He left us! He left us!
Tim blinked to recover his vision. When he looked again, the Tyrannosaur was standing there, exactly as before, motionless and huge. Rain dripped from its jaws. The forelimb gripped the fence. And then Tim realized the Tyrannosaur was holding on to the fence. The fence wasn't electrified anymore.
Lex, close the door!
The radio crackled. Tim!
I'm here, Dr. Grant.
What's going on?
Regis ran away, Tim said.
He what?
He ran away. I think he saw that the fence isn't electrified, Tim said.
The fence isn't electrified, Malcolm said over the radio. Did he say the fence isn't electrified?
Lex, Tim said, close the door!
But Lex was screaming.
He left us! He left us!
In a steady, monotonous wail, and there was nothing for Tim to do but climb out of the back door into the slashing rain and shut the door for her. Thunder rumbled, and the lightning flashed again. Tim looked up and saw the Tyrannosaur crashing down the cyclone fence with a giant hind limb.
Timmy!
He jumped back in and slammed the door, the sound lost in the thunderclap. The radio. Tim, are you there? He grabbed the radio.
I'm here.
He turned to Lex.
Lock the doors! Get in the middle of the car and shut up!
Outside, the Tyrannosaur rolled its head and took an awkward step forward. The claws of its feet had caught in the grid of the flattened fence. Lex saw the animal finally and became silent, still. She watched with wide eyes. Radio crackle. Tim.
Yes, Dr. Grant.
Stay in the car. Stay down. Be quiet. Don't move. And don't make noise.
Okay.
You should be all right. I don't think it can open the car.
Okay.
Just stay quiet so you don't arouse its attention any more than necessary.
Okay.
Tim clicked the radio off.
You hear that, Lex?
His sister nodded silently. She never took her eyes off the dinosaur. The Tyrannosaur roared. In the glare of lightning, they saw it pull free of the fence and take a bounding step forward. Now it was standing between the two cars. Tim couldn't see Dr. Grant's car anymore because the huge body blocked his view. The rain ran in rivulets down the pebbled skin of the muscular hind legs. He couldn't see the animal's head, which was high above the roofline. The Tyrannosaur moved around the side of their car. It went to the very spot where Tim had gotten out of the car, where Ed Regis had gotten out of the car. The animal paused there, the big head ducked down toward the mud.
Tim looked back at Dr. Grant and Dr. Malcolm in the rear car. Their faces were tense as they stared forward through the windshield. The huge head raised back up, jaws open, and then stopped by the side windows. In the glare of lightning, they saw the beady, expressionless, reptile eye moving in the socket. It was looking in the car. His sister's breath came in ragged, frightened gasps. He reached out and squeezed her arm, hoping she would stay quiet. The dinosaur continued to stare for a long time through the side window. Perhaps the dinosaur couldn't really see them, he thought. Finally, the head lifted up out of view again.
Jimmy,
Lex whispered.
It's okay, Tim whispered. I don't think it saw us.
He was looking back toward Dr. Grant when a jolting impact rocked the Land Cruiser and shattered the windshield in a spider web as a Tyrannosaur's head crashed against the hood of the Land Cruiser. Tim was knocked flat on the seat. The night vision goggles slid off his forehead. He got back up quickly, blinking in the darkness, his mouth warm with blood.
Lex?
He couldn't see his sister anywhere. The Tyrannosaur stood near the front of the Land Cruiser, its chest moving as it breathed, the forelimbs making clawing movements in the air.
Lex!
Tim whispered. Then he heard her groan. She was lying somewhere on the floor, under the front seat. Then the huge head came down, entirely blocking the shattered windshield. The Tyrannosaur banged again in the front hood of the Land Cruiser. Tim grabbed the seat as the car rocked on its wheels. The Tyrannosaur banged down twice more, denting the metal. Then it moved around the side of the car. The big raised tail blocked his view out of all the side windows. At the back, the animal snorted a deep, rumbling growl that blended with the thunder. It sank its jaws into the spare tire mounted on the back of the Land Cruiser, and in a single headshake, tore it away. The rear of the car lifted into the air for a moment, then it thumped down with a muddy splash.
Tim!
Dr. Grant said. Tim! Are you there? Tim grabbed the radio.
We're okay, he said.
There was a shrill metallic scrape as claws raked the roof of the car. Tim's heart was pounding in his chest. He couldn't see anything out of the windows on the right side except pebbled, leathery flesh. The Tyrannosaur was leaning against the car, which rocked back and forth with each breath, the springs and metal creaking loudly. Lex groaned again. Tim put down the radio and started to crawl over into the front seat. The Tyrannosaur roared, and the metal roof dented downward. Tim felt a sharp pain in his head and tumbled to the floor onto the transmission hump. He found himself lying alongside Lex, and he was shocked to see that the whole side of her head was covered in blood. She looked unconscious. There was another jolting impact, and pieces of glass fell all around him. Tim felt rain. He looked up and saw that the front windshield had broken out. There was just a jagged rim of glass, and beyond, the big head of the dinosaur, looking down at him. Tim felt a sudden chill, and then the head rushed forward toward him, the jaws open. There was a squeal of metal against teeth, and he felt the hot, stinking breath of the animal, and a thick tongue stuck into the car through the windshield opening. The tongue slapped wetly around inside the car. He felt the hot lather of dinosaur saliva, and the Tyrannosaur roared, a deafening sound inside the car. The head pulled away abruptly. Tim scrambled up, avoiding the dent in the roof. There was still room to sit on the front seat by the passenger door. The Tyrannosaur stood in the rain near the front fender. It seemed confused by what had happened to it. Blood dripped freely from its jaws. The Tyrannosaur looked at Tim, cocking its head to stare with one big eye. The head moved close to the car, sideways, and peered in. Blood spattered on the dented hood of the Land Cruiser, mixing with the rain.
It can't get to me,
Tim thought.
It's too big.
Then the head pulled away, and in the glare of lightning he saw the hind leg lift up, and the world tilted crazily as the Land Cruiser slammed over on his side, the windows splatting in the mud. He saw Lex fall helplessly against the side window, and he fell down beside her, banging his head.
Tim felt dizzy.
Then the Tyrannosaur's jaws clamped onto the window frame, and the whole Land Cruiser was lifted up into the air and shaken.
Timmy!
Lex shrieked, so near to his ear that it hurt. She was suddenly awake, and he grabbed her as the Tyrannosaur crashed the car down again. Tim felt a stabbing pain in his side, and his sister fell on top of him. The car went up again, tilting crazily. Lex shouted,
Timmy!
and he saw the door give way beneath her, and she fell out of the car into the mud. But Tim couldn't answer, because in the next instant everything swung crazily. He saw the trunks of the palm trees sliding downward past him, moving sideways through the air. He glimpsed the ground, very far below, the hot roar of the Tyrannosaur, the blazing eye, the tops of the palm trees. And then, with a metallic scraping shriek, the car fell from the Tyrannosaur's jaws, a sickening fall, and Tim's stomach heaved in the moment before the world became totally black and silent. In the other car, Malcolm gasped, "Jesus, what happened to the car?" Grant blinked his eyes as the lightning faded. The other car was gone. Grant couldn't believe it. He peered forward, trying to see through the rain-streaked windshield. The dinosaur's body was so large, it was probably just blocking... No. In another flash of lightning, he saw clearly the car was gone. "What happened?" Malcolm said. "I don't know." Faintly over the rain, Grant heard the sound of the little girl screaming. The dinosaur was standing in the darkness on the road up ahead, but they could see well enough to know that it was bending over now, sniffing the ground, or eating something on the ground. "Can you see?" Malcolm said, squinting. "Not much, no," Grant said. The rain pounded on the roof of the car. He listened for the little girl, but he didn't hear her anymore. The two men sat in the car, listening. "Was it the girl?" Malcolm said finally. "It sounded like the girl."
"It did, yes."
"Was it?"
"I don't know," Grant said.
He felt a seeping fatigue overtake him. Blurred through the rainy windshield, the dinosaur was coming toward their car. Slow, ominous strides coming right toward them. Malcolm said, "You know, at times like this one feels, well, perhaps extinct animals should be left extinct. Don't you have that feeling now?" "Yes," Grant said. He was feeling his heart pounding. Do you have any suggestions about what we do now?"
"I can't think of a thing," Grant said.
Malcolm twisted the handle, kicked open the door, and ran. But even as he did, Grant could see he was too late. The Tyrannosaur too close. There was another crack of lightning, and in that instant of glaring white light, Grant watched in horror as the Tyrannosaur roared and leapt forward. Grant was not clear about exactly what happened next. Malcolm was running, his feet splashing in the mud. The Tyrannosaur bounded alongside him and ducked its massive head, and Malcolm was tossed into the air like a small doll. By then, Grant was out of the car too, feeling the cold rain slashing his face and body. The Tyrannosaur had turned its back to him, the huge tail swinging through the air. Grant was tensing to run for the woods, when suddenly the Tyrannosaur spun back to face him and roared. Grant froze. He was standing beside the passenger door of the Land Cruiser, drenched in rain. He was completely exposed, the Tyrannosaur no more than 8 feet away. The big animal roared again. At so close a range, the sound was terrifyingly loud. Grant felt himself shaking with cold and fright. He pressed his trembling hands against the metal of the door panel to steady them. The Tyrannosaur roared once more, but it did not attack. It cocked its head and looked with first one eye, then the other, at the Land Cruiser. And it did nothing. It just stood there. What was going on? The powerful jaws opened and closed. The Tyrannosaur bellowed angrily. And then the big hind leg came up and crashed down on the roof of the car. The claws slid off with a metal screech, barely missing Grant as he stood there still unmoving. The foot splashed in the mud. The head ducked down in a slow arc, and the animal inspected the car, snorting. It peered into the front windshield. Then, moving toward the rear, it banged the passenger door shut and moved right toward Grant as he stood there. Grant was dizzy with fear, his heart pounding inside his chest. With the animal so close, he could smell the rotten flesh in the mouth, the sweetish blood smell, the sickening stench of the carnivore. He tensed his body, awaiting the inevitable. The big head slid past him, toward the rear of the car. Grant blinked. What had happened? Was it possible the Tyrannosaur hadn't seen him? It seemed as if it hadn't, but how could that be?
Grant looked back to see the animal sniffing the rear-mounted tire. It nudged the tire with its snout, and then the head swung back. Again it approached Grant. This time the animal stopped, the black flaring nostrils just inches away. Grant felt the animal's startling hot breath on his face. But the Tyrannosaur wasn't sniffing like a dog, it was just breathing. And if anything, it seemed puzzled. No. The Tyrannosaur couldn't see him. Not if he stood motionless. And in a detached academic corner of his mind, he found an explanation for that, a reason why. The jaws opened before him, the massive head raised up. Grant squeezed his fists together and bit his lip, trying desperately to remain motionless, to make no sound. The Tyrannosaur bellowed in the night air. But by now Grant was beginning to understand. The animal couldn't see him, but it suspected he was there, somewhere, and was trying with its bellowing to frighten Grant into some revealing movement. So long as he stood his ground, Grant realized he was invisible. In a final gesture of frustration, the big hind leg lifted up and kicked the Land Cruiser over, and Grant felt searing pain and the surprising sensation of his own body flying through the air. It seemed to be happening very slowly, and he had plenty of time to feel the world turn colder and watch the ground rush up to strike him in the face. Return. Oh, damn, Harding said. Will you look at that? They were sitting in Harding's gasoline-powered jeep, staring forward past the flick-flick of the windshield wipers. In the yellow flare of the headlamps, a big fallen tree blocked the road. Must have been the lightning, Gennaro said. Hell of a tree. We can't get past it, Harding said. I better tell Arnold in control. He picked up the radio and twisted the channel dial. Hello, John. Are you there, John? There was nothing but steady, hissing static. I don't understand, he said. The radio lines seem to be down. It must be the storm, Gennaro said. I suppose, Harding said.
Try the Land Cruisers, Ellie said.
Harding opened the other channels, but there was no answer. Nothing, he said. They're probably back to camp by now, and outside the range of our little set. In any case, I don't think we should stay here. It'll be hours before maintenance gets a crew out here to move that tree. He turned the radio off and put the jeep into reverse.
What are you going to do?
Ellie said. Go back to the turnout and get onto the maintenance road. Fortunately, there's a second road system, Harding explained. We have one road for visitors and a second road for animal handlers and feed trucks and so on. We'll drive back on that maintenance road. It's a little longer and not so scenic, but you may find it interesting. If the rain lets up, we'll get a glimpse of some of the animals at night. We should be back in 30-40 minutes, Harding said, if I don't get lost. He turned the jeep around in the night and headed south again. Lightning flashed, and every monitor in the control room went black. Arnold sat forward, his body rigid and tense. Jesus, not now, not now. That was all he needed, to have everything go out now in the storm. All the main power circuits were surge-protected, of course, but Arnold wasn't sure about the modems Nedry was using for his data transmission. Most people didn't know it was possible to blow an entire system through a modem. The lightning pulse climbed back into the computer through the telephone line, and bang, no more motherboard, no more RAM, no more file server, no more computer. The screens flickered, and then one by one they came back on. Arnold sighed and collapsed back in his chair. He wondered again where Nedry had gone. 5 minutes ago he'd sent guards to search the building for him. The fat bastard was probably in the bathroom reading a comic book. But the guards hadn't come back, and they hadn't called in. 5 minutes. If Nedry was in the building, they should have found him by now. Somebody took the damn jeep, Muldoon said as he came back in the room. Have you talked to the Land Cruisers yet? Can't raise them on the radio, Arnold said. I have to use this because the main board is down. It's weak, but it ought to work. I've tried on all 6 channels. I know they have radios in the cars, but they're not answering. That's not good, Muldoon said. If you want to go out there, take one of the maintenance vehicles. I would, Muldoon said, but they're all in the east garage, more than a mile from here. Where's Harding? I assume he's on his way back. Then he'll pick up the people in the Land Cruisers on his way. I assume so.
Anybody tell Hammond the kids aren't back yet?
Hell no, Arnold said. I don't want that son of a bitch running around here screaming at me. Everything's all right for the moment. The Land Cruisers are just stuck in the rain. They can sit a while until Harding brings them back. Or until we find Nedry and make that little bastard turn the systems back on.
You can't get them back on?
Muldoon said. Arnold shook his head. I've been trying, but Nedry's done something to the system. I can't figure out what. But if I have to go into the code itself, that'll take hours.
We need Nedry. We've got to find the son of a bitch right away.
Nedry. The sign said, electrified fence, 10,000 volts, do not touch. But Nedry opened it with his bare hand and unlocked the gate, swinging it wide. He went back to the jeep, drove through the gate, and then walked back to close it behind him. Now he was inside the park itself, no more than a mile from the east dock. He stepped on the accelerator and hunched forward over the steering wheel, peering through the rain-slashed windshield as he drove the jeep down the narrow road. He was driving fast, too fast, but he had to keep to his timetable. He was surrounded on all sides by black jungle, but soon he should be able to see the beach and the ocean off to his left. This damn storm, he thought. It might screw up everything, because if Dodgson's boat wasn't waiting for him at the east dock when Nedry got there, the whole plan would be ruined. Nedry couldn't wait very long, or he would be missed back at the control room. The whole idea behind the plan was that he could drive to the east dock, drop off the embryos, and be back in a few minutes, before anyone noticed. It was a good plan, a clever plan. Nedry'd worked on it carefully, refining every detail. This plan was going to make him $1.5 million, 1.5 meg. That was 10 years of income in a single tax-free shot, and it was going to change his life. Nedry'd been damn careful, even to the point of making Dodgson meet him in the San Francisco airport at the last minute with an excuse about wanting to see the money. Actually, Nedry wanted to record his conversation with Dodgson and mention him by name on the tape, just so that Dodgson wouldn't forget he owed the rest of the money. Nedry was including a copy of the tape with the embryos. In short, Nedry had thought of everything. Except this damn storm. Something dashed across the road, a white flash in his headlights. It looked like a large rat. It scurried into the underbrush, dragging a fat tail. Possum. Amazing that a possum could survive here. You'd think the dinosaurs would get an animal like that. Where was the damn dock? He was driving fast, and he'd already been gone 5 minutes. He should have reached the east dock by now. Had he taken a wrong turn? He didn't think so. He hadn't seen any forks in the road at all. Then where was the dock? It was a shock when he came around a corner and saw that the road terminated in a gray concrete barrier, 6 feet tall and streaked dark with rain. He slammed on the brakes, and the jeep fishtailed, losing traction in an end-to-end spin, and for a horrified moment he thought he was going to smash into the barrier. He knew he was going to smash. And he spun the wheel frantically, and the jeep slid to a stop, the headlamps just a foot from the concrete wall. He paused there, listening to the rhythmic flick of the wipers. He took a deep breath and exhaled slowly. He looked back down the road. He'd obviously taken a wrong turn somewhere. He could retrace his steps, but that would take too long. He'd better try and find out where the hell he was. He got out of the jeep, feeling heavy raindrops spatter his head. It was a real tropical storm, raining so hard that it hurt. He glanced at his watch, pushing the button to illuminate the digital dial. 6 minutes gone. Where the hell was he? He walked around the concrete barrier, and on the other side, along with the rain, he heard the sound of gurgling water. Could it be the ocean? Nedry hurried forward, his eyes adjusting to the darkness as he went. Dense jungle on all sides, raindrops slapping on the leaves. The gurgling sound became louder, drawing him forward, and suddenly he came out of the foliage and felt his feet sink into soft earth and saw the dark currents of the river. The river! He was at the jungle river. Damn, he thought. At the river where? The river ran for miles through the island. He looked at his watch again. 7 minutes gone. You have a problem, Dennis, he said aloud. As if in reply, there was a soft hooting cry of an owl in the forest.
Nedry hardly noticed. He was worrying about his plan. The plain fact was that time had run out. There wasn't a choice anymore. He had to abandon his original plan. All he could do was go back to the control room, restore the computer, and somehow try to contact Dodgson to set up the drop at the East Dock for the following night. Nedry would have to scramble to make that work, but he thought he could pull it off. The computer automatically logged all calls. After Nedry got through to Dodgson, he'd have to go back into the computer and erase the record of the call, but one thing was sure. He couldn't stay out in the park any longer, or his absence would be noticed. Nedry started back, heading toward the glow of the car's headlights. He was drenched and miserable. He heard the soft hooting cry once more, and this time he paused. That hadn't really sounded like an owl, and it seemed to be close by, in the jungle, somewhere off to his right. As he listened, he heard a crashing sound in the underbrush, then silence. He waited, and heard it again. It sounded distinctly like something big, moving slowly through the jungle toward him. Something big, something near, a big dinosaur. Get out of here. Nedry began to run. He made a lot of noise as he ran, but even so, he could hear the animal crashing through the foliage and hooting. It was coming closer. Stumbling over tree roots in the darkness, clawing his way past dripping branches, he saw the jeep ahead, and the lights shining around the vertical wall of the barrier made him feel better. In a moment, he'd be in the car, and then he'd get the hell out of here. He scrambled around the barrier, and then he froze. The animal was already there. But it wasn't close. The dinosaur stood 40 feet away at the edge of the illumination from the headlamps. Nedry hadn't taken the tour, so he hadn't seen the different types of dinosaurs, but this one was strange-looking. The 10-foot-tall body was yellow with black spots, and along the head ran a pair of red, V-shaped crests. The dinosaur didn't move, but again gave its soft hooting cry. Nedry waited to see if it would attack. It didn't. Perhaps the headlights from the jeep frightened it, forcing it to keep its distance like a fire. The dinosaur stared at him, and then snapped its head in a single swift motion. Nedry felt something smack wetly against his chest. He looked down and saw a dripping glob of foam on his rain-soaked shirt. He touched it curiously, not comprehending. It was spit. The dinosaur had spit on him. It was creepy, he thought. He looked back at the dinosaur and saw the head snap again, and immediately felt another wet smack against his neck, just above the shirt collar. He wiped it away with his hand. Jesus, it was disgusting. But the skin of his neck was already starting to tingle and burn, and his hand was tingling too. It was almost like he had been touched with acid. Nedry opened the car door, glancing back at the dinosaur to make sure it wasn't going to attack, and felt a sudden excruciating pain in his eyes, stabbing like spikes into the back of his skull, and he squeezed his eyes shut and gasped with the intensity of it, then threw up his hands to cover his eyes and felt the slippery foam trickling down both sides of his nose. Spit! The dinosaur had spit in his eyes! Even as he realized it, the pain overwhelmed him, and he dropped to his knees, disoriented, wheezing. He collapsed onto his side, his cheek pressed to the wet ground, his breath coming in thin whistles through the constant, ever-screaming pain that caused flashing spots of light to appear behind his tightly shut eyelids. The earth shook beneath him, and Nedry knew the dinosaur was moving. He could hear its soft hooting cry, and despite the pain, he forced his eyes open. And still he saw nothing but flashing spots against black. Slowly the realization came to him. He was blind. The hooting was louder as Nedry scrambled to his feet and staggered back against the side panel of the car as a wave of nausea and dizziness swept over him. The dinosaur was close now. He could feel it coming close. He was dimly aware of its snorting breath, but he couldn't see. He couldn't see anything. And his terror was extreme. He stretched out his hands, waving them wildly in the air to ward off the attack he knew was coming. And then there was a new searing pain, like a fiery knife in his belly. And Nedry stumbled, reaching blindly down to touch the ragged edge of his shirt, and then a thick, slippery mass that was surprisingly warm. And with horror, he suddenly knew he was holding his own intestines in his hands.
The dinosaur had torn him open. His guts had fallen out.
Nedry fell to the ground and landed on something scaly and cold. It was the animal's foot. And then there was a new pain on both sides of his head. The pain grew worse. And as he was lifted to his feet, he knew the dinosaur had his head in its jaws. And the horror of that realization was followed by a final wish that it would all be ended soon.
Bungalow.
More coffee? Hammond asked politely.
No, thank you, Henry Wu said, leaning back in his chair. I couldn't eat anything more.
They were sitting in the dining room of Hammond's bungalow in a secluded corner of the park not far from the labs. Wu had to admit that the bungalow Hammond had built for himself was elegant, with sparse, almost Japanese lines. And the dinner had been excellent, considering the dining room wasn't fully staffed yet. But there was something about Hammond that Wu found troubling. The old man was different in some way, subtly different. All during dinner, Wu had tried to decide what it was. In part, a tendency to ramble, to repeat himself, to retell old stories. In part, it was an emotional lability, flaring anger one moment, maudlin sentimentality the next. But all that could be understood as a natural concomitant of age. John Hammond was, after all, almost 77. But there was something else. A stubborn evasiveness, an insistence on having his way, and in the end a complete refusal to deal with the situation that now faced the park. Wu had been stunned by the evidence. He did not yet allow himself to believe the case was proved, that the dinosaurs were breeding. After Grant had asked about amphibian DNA, Wu had intended to go directly to his laboratory and check the computer records of the various DNA assemblies, because if the dinosaurs were in fact breeding, then everything about Jurassic Park was called into question. Their genetic development methods, their genetic control methods, everything. Even the lysine dependency might be suspect. And if these animals could truly breed and could also survive in the wild... Henry Wu wanted to check the data at once, but Hammond had stubbornly insisted Wu accompany him at dinner.
"Now then, Henry, you must save room for ice cream," Hammond said, pushing back from the table. "Maria makes the most wonderful ginger ice cream."
"All right." Wu looked at the beautiful, silent serving girl. His eyes followed her out of the room, and then he glanced up at the single video monitor mounted in the wall. The monitor was dark.
"Your monitor's out," Wu said.
"Is it?" Hammond glanced over. "Must be the storm." He reached behind him for the telephone.
"I'll just check with John in control."
Wu could hear the static crackle on the telephone line. Hammond shrugged and set the receiver back in its cradle.
"Lines must be down," he said. "Or maybe Nedry's still doing data transmission. He has quite a few bugs to fix this weekend. Nedry's a genius in his way, but we had to press him quite hard toward the end to make sure he got things right."
"Perhaps I should go to the control room and check," Wu said.
"No, no," Hammond said. "There's no reason. If there were any problem, we'd hear about it."
"Ah." Maria came back into the room with two plates of ice cream.
"You must have just a little, Henry," Hammond said. "It's made with fresh ginger from the eastern part of the island. It's an old man's vice ice cream, but still..."
Dutifully, Wu dipped his spoon. Outside, lightning flashed, and there was the sharp crack of thunder.
"That was close," Wu said. "I hope the storm isn't frightening the children." "I shouldn't think so," Hammond said.
He tasted the ice cream.
"But I can't help but hold some fears about this park, Henry."
Inwardly, Wu felt relieved. Perhaps the old man was going to face the facts after all.
"What kind of fears?" "You know, Jurassic Park's really made for children. The children of the world love dinosaurs, and the children are going to delight, just delight in this place. Their little faces will shine with the joy of finally seeing these wonderful animals. But I am afraid. I may not live to see it, Henry. I may not live to see the joy on their faces."
"I think there are other problems, too," Wu said, frowning.
"But none so pressing on my mind as this," Hammond said, that I may not live to see their shining, delighted faces. This is our triumph, this park. We have done what we set out to do. And you remember our original intent was to use the newly emerging technology of genetic engineering to make money. A lot of money.
Wu knew Hammond was about to launch into one of his old speeches. He held up his hand.
I'm familiar with this, John. If you were going to start a bioengineering company, Henry, what would you do? Would you make products to help mankind? To fight illness and disease? Dear me, no. That's a terrible idea. A very poor use of new technology.
Hammond shook his head sadly.
Yet you'll remember, he said, the original genetic engineering companies like Genentech and Cetus were all started to make pharmaceuticals. New drugs for mankind. Noble, noble purpose. Unfortunately, drugs face all kinds of barriers. FDA testing alone takes 5 to 8 years, if you're lucky. Even worse, there are forces at work in the marketplace. Suppose you make a miracle drug for cancer or heart disease, as Genentech did. Suppose you now want to charge $1,000 or $2,000 a dose. You might imagine that is your privilege. After all, you invented the drug. You paid to develop and test it. You should be able to charge whatever you wish. But do you really think that the government will let you do that? No, Henry, they will not. Sick people aren't going to pay $1,000 a dose for needed medication. They won't be grateful, they'll be outraged. Blue Cross isn't going to pay it. They'll scream highway robbery. So something will happen. Your patent application will be denied, your permits will be delayed. Something will force you to see reason and to sell your drug at a lower cost. From a business standpoint, that makes helping mankind a very risky business. Personally, I would never help mankind.
Wu had heard the argument before, and he knew Hammond was right. Some new bioengineered pharmaceuticals had indeed suffered inexplicable delays and patent problems.
Now, Hammond said, think how different it is when you're making entertainment. Nobody needs entertainment. That's not a matter for government intervention. If I charge $5,000 a day for my park, who is going to stop me? After all, nobody needs to come here. And far from being highway robbery, a costly price tag actually increases the appeal of the park. A visit becomes a status symbol, and all Americans love that. So do the Japanese. And, of course, they have far more money.
Hammond finished his ice cream, and Maria silently took the dish away.
She's not from here, you know, he said. She's Haitian. Her mother is French. But in any case, Henry, you will recall that the original purpose behind pointing my company in this direction in the first place was to have freedom from government intervention anywhere in the world.
Speaking of the rest of the world, Hammond smiled,
we have already leased a large tract in the Azores for Jurassic Park Europe, and you know we long ago obtained an island near Guam for Jurassic Park Japan. Construction on the next two Jurassic Parks will begin early next year. They will all be open within 4 years. At that time, direct revenues will exceed $10 billion a year. And merchandising, television, and ancillary rights should double that. I see no reason to bother with children's pets, which I'm told Lou Dodgson thinks we're planning to make.
$20 billion a year, Wu said softly, shaking his head.
That's speaking conservatively, Hammond said.
He smiled.
There's no reason to speculate wildly. More ice cream, Henry.
Did you find him? Arnold snapped when the guard walked into the control room.
No, Mr. Arnold. Find him. I don't think he's in the building, Mr. Arnold.
Then look in the lodge, Arnold said. Look in the maintenance building. Look in the utility shed. Look everywhere. But just find him.
The thing is, the guard hesitated, Mr. Nedry's the fat man, is that right?
That's right, Arnold said. He's fat. A fat slob.
Well, Jimmy, down in the main lobby, said he saw the fat man go into the garage.
Muldoon spun around.
Into the garage? When?
About 10-15 minutes ago.
Jesus, Muldoon said. The jeep screeched to a stop.
Sorry, Harding said.
In the headlamps, Ellie saw a herd of apatosaurs lumbering across the road. There were six animals, each the size of a house, and a baby as large as a full-grown horse. The apatosaurs moved in unhurried silence, never looking toward the jeep and its glowing headlamps. At one point, the baby stopped to lap